Hello and welcome to the InFocus podcast. I'm G. Sampath, the Hindu's social affairs editor. If you are someone who has some kind of a loan going, either a home loan or a car loan or credit card payments due, you would be aware of the loan moratorium option that is currently active. To help people whose cash flows and incomes were suddenly disrupted by COVID-19 and the COVID-linked lockdown, the RBI back in March announced a loan moratorium scheme. The scheme was initially for 3 months from March to May. It was then extended for another 3 months till August 31st. Now, as we enter the last month of this extension, there is yet another round of debate on whether the moratorium scheme should get another extension, say till December. Please remember that so long as the moratoriums are in place and people won't be tested for their ability to repay, that is pay their EMIs, and unless this test happens, banks have no way to know how many more of their loans have gone bad. So what we're going to try and understand here is, should the government extend or not extend the moratorium? What are the issues involved in either of these decisions? What's at stake for the banks? What does it mean for the consumer? And what does it mean for the economy? To answer these questions, we have with us Vivek Kaul, well-known business columnist, personal finance expert, and the best-selling author of the Easy Money Trilogy. His latest book, which came out last month, is on a subject that is supremely pertinent to the theme of this podcast. It's called Bad Money, Inside the NPA Mess and How It Threatens the Indian Banking System. Vivek, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sampath, for having me.
To start with, let's go with the fundamental question here. Were moratoriums on repayments a good idea in the first place, or could we have done without them altogether?
That's a tricky one. I think when they came, they were sort of initially initiated towards the end of March. The government and the banks were in uncharted territory. So I think to that extent, you couldn't have blamed them for coming up with something like this. I don't know if it was a good idea or a bad idea, that time will only tell, but it was something that probably needed to be done and was done.
No, wasn't, wouldn't a cash transfer have been a better idea for a COVID disruption, like say how Germany did it?
So cash transfer is, that's another idea. Here, the problem was that many people who suddenly lost their jobs or their incomes were slashed, or even companies for that matter, when, economic activity came totally to a standstill, wouldn't really have been in a position to continue repaying the loans. So a cash transfer wouldn't really have helped. How much cash can the government really transfer at the end of the day? So this was a different idea trying to address a different problem from what a cash transfer would.
Okay, I mean cash transfers in terms of how Germany gave money to the employers so that they didn't have to cut salaries, as a result of which, this loan repayment don't happen.
But then see, the thing is that the size in the Indian case, the size of the cash transfer, if it had to sort of replace the moratorium, would have been terribly huge. And I really don't think the government was or is in a position to come up with money, money like that. So.
Okay. But is there any way one can measure the impact of a moratorium like this? How do we know whether it works?
It's like this. So there are, most banks sort of gave the borrowers an option of an opt-in. Okay. So it was only if you wanted the moratorium, would you opt for it. Now, there were banks which also had an opt-out option wherein, everyone was put on a moratorium, and then if you didn't require it, you had the option of opting out. But they were few and far between. So the moment you have an opt-in option, you opt for it, only because you're really not in a position to continue repaying the loan, or you want to sort of preserve cash and have some cash in hand. Now, obviously, anyone who's doing this, I'm not talking about some random individual guys who really do not understand you know, the cost of taking on a moratorium. But let's say any mid-level corporate or any guy who's reasonably aware of the situation would know that a moratorium comes with a cost attached to it, right? So it's not like, you know, there is no cost attached. The interest that, you know, that you would have paid on the loan for this period ends up getting accumulated and is added on to the principal outstanding. And then you have to repay the principal outstanding. So in the end, you end up paying not just the interest, you end up paying interest on interest. And I don't remember the exact calculation now, but you know, when this had originally happened, I remember very, very clearly that the EMI on a 30 lakh rupees, the number of EMIs on a 30 lakh rupees home loan went up by 8 installments or something like that. So there was a cost, there is a cost attached to it. And I mean, you know, if you understand that there is a cost attached to it, you will only do it, if you really are not in a position to repay the loan.
When some bankers, like for example, I think they have been saying that a lot of people have taken advantage of this moratorium to preserve their capital. But I've never understood this. Why would they do that when they know that the interest, as you pointed out just now, is going to accumulate?
Yes, I mean, I have also been thinking about this. And I mean, I guess the only explanation is that, you know, in times like these, Sampath, when there is a huge crisis on, everyone likes to hold on to a little bit of cash, extra cash. And they don't mind paying a little interest on it, that be the case. I guess that's the only explanation for that, because I can't think of any other explanation which justifies paying interest on interest.
So coming back to the core debate here, so should the government extend the moratorium for a second time? What are the pros and cons according to you?
So again, it's a tricky question, because there isn't really any data going around which one can look at and safely say they should extend or they should not extend. So here's the thing, okay? People who have short loan tenures, if you extend the moratorium,
what do you mean by short? Like how short is short?
I mean, let's say people who have to repay the loans over the next 2 to 3 years, something like that. And okay. So they, if you sort of extend the moratorium again for 3 months, I'm really not sure as to how much of a difference will it make in their repayment capability. But people who have long-term tenures, let's say, you know, you have a home loan which you need to, you know, repay over 15 years, or companies have long-term decadal, you know, more than 10-year loans. So in that case, it might make a little bit of a difference. But all in all, I think it's not a good banking practice, because all you're doing is essentially you're kicking the can down the road, and you shouldn't be doing that. So
okay. So would you then say that a one-time restructuring of loans would be a better idea than extending the moratorium?
I mean, see, again, you know, I think it's the same thing. Even if you do a one-time restructuring. I'll give you a little bit of history here. Now, you know, look at what has been happening over the last 10 years when it comes to public sector banks. At least the problem of bad loans in public sector banks was recognized as way back as 2011. But nothing was done up until 2015, and the banks were really, allowed to restructure loans in different ways. By the RBI, and they essentially ended up kicking the can down the road. Now the hope was that restructuring would help and companies will be able to repay the loans, or the other hope was that in the years to come the banks would sort of give out so many more loans that the proportion of bad loans as a proportion of overall loans would come down dramatically. Now, neither of these things happened, and in the end, 2015 on, the RBI had to crack down, the government had to recapitalize these banks. So, in the process, in the process of postponing the problem, we ended up creating a bigger problem. Now, I'm really not sure. See, the thing is this. The moment you do a one-time restructuring, do you really think it's going to stop at that?
Let me just interject here. See, this is a very good point you're making. I understand it, what you're trying to say. But two questions here. Is it really fair and justified to make a comparison between loans we give to companies versus loans we give to consumers?
Okay.
And B, given the fact that it's been well established that public sector banks have not performed very differently when it comes to NPAs and loan assessment, when it comes to retail customers,
right?
They have done very badly with corporate loans.
Right.
But what are the factors at play there? Political influence, etc. But when it comes to retail lending, public sector banks have not done much worse than private sector banks. So, given this, do you think, considering those other toxic factors or not, restructuring might play out differently for retail banks?
Your point is well taken, and the fact that you want me to differentiate between corporate loans and retail loans is also well taken. Now, the problem is, at the banking level, I don't think there is any experience in restructuring retail loans. Okay. Obviously, this is something that will have to be thought through very, very carefully as to, what do you exactly mean by restructuring a loan? Do you sort of, again, give the consumer an option of postponing paying his EMI, which is something that moratorium already offers? Do you sort of lower his interest rate? Interest rates are already very, very low. I mean, you can get a new home loan for as low as 7%. Do you sort of only ask him to keep repaying interest for a while and postpone repaying the principal? This is, I think, what will happen is, and I think the better thing to do here is to let individual banks decide on how they want to follow this up, because any sort of central planning is not going to work here. Banks also, it's ultimately the banks and the bankers who are closest to the retail customers, and they really know the real situation. So it's better to sort of leave it to them than sort of have a something at the central, at the RBI level, dictating that this is what you need to do. Because one needs to remember this fact, and this is something that everyone seems to forget when they talk about banks and banking, is the fact that banks don't just lend, they also raise deposits. And unless these lend, unless what has been lent is repaid, how does the bank redeem the deposit? Or how does the bank redeem the deposit 100%? So that is a factor that needs to be kept in mind, because you don't want people to sort of lose trust in the banking system in the country, because that will be an even bigger trouble than the one we are in currently.
Now, you sort of briefly looked at different options in terms of restructuring, lowering interest rates and so on. What if there is a combination of slightly lower interest rates on case-to-case basis and the bank takes a haircut? Wouldn't that decrease the likelihood of bad loans if the bank takes a
which is what I'm trying to say. So my point is, it's better if the individual banks decide on what they are expected to do. The problem here is that I don't see this playing out well in public sector banks, because there, the fear of what they call the three C's, the courts, the CBI's, CBI and the Central Vigilance Commission is very, very high. So ultimately what will happen is that, the small borrowers, and by small borrowers, I don't just mean the retail borrowers. I mean, I also mean the, smaller corporate borrowers will get treated differently than the bigger corporate borrowers, as has always been the case.
Let's say that the state and the RBI follows your logic and they decide against extending the moratorium.
Right.
In that case, wouldn't we then suddenly see a big spurt in bad loans at the end of after August 31st?
Not at the end of August 31st. There is a 90-day period. So a bad loan is essentially defined as a loan which has been defaulted on a period of 90 days, for a period of 90 days or more. So the recognition will actually start as of December 1st.
So will there be a big spurt in NPAs after December?
Yeah, it has to, no, Sampath. I mean, that's. So if you look at the data right now, what it tells us is that nearly 50% of the loans, banking loans, are in a moratorium. Now, even if even if 1/10 of that or 1/20 of that goes bad, you know, you are looking at a number running into lakhs of crores. So there has to be, see, there has to be some collateral damage. I mean, we are not in a, you know, this is a huge, you know, negative thing which has happened, and there will be collateral damage because of that. So
speaking of collateral damage, the RBI's projections, I mean, according to whatever I can gather, says that NPAs could be as high as 12.5 to 14.7% next year. Right. Now, with all these moratorium-related stuff coming out in the open, say, by December or so, with or without one-time restructuring, how bad do you think it's going to affect the banking?
Okay. So, I had recently written a piece in which I essentially did some basic calculations, assuming that 50% of the loans are under a moratorium as of August 31st. And if 5%, 10%, 15%, and 20% of those loans go bad. So at 5%, the bad loans amount to around 2.55 lakh crore. At 10%, at around 5.1 lakh crore. And at 20%, at around a little over 10 lakh crore. Now, so I really don't know how bad the situation is going to be, but it's going to be, something which we have never seen before. When it comes to RBI forecasts, I've studied this very closely over the years, and RBI's forecasts, even their severe, what they call a severe scenario, severe stress scenario, turns out to be wrong. So to give you an example, so between 2016 and 2018, the actual bad loans rate was higher than the one the RBI had estimated in a severe stress scenario. Now, the economy was nowhere near a severe stress scenario, but the bad loans rate was higher than what was estimated in a severe stress scenario. This time around, the RBI has come up with an even higher category called the very severe stress scenario. And in the very severe stress scenario, they say that around 14.7% of the bad loans rate will be 14.7%. Now, given that the total amount of bank lending is around 102-103 lakh crore, what they're talking about is basically around 15 lakh crore of loans will go bad. So, which is in line with what I have, my calculations also say. So, if 50%, if 10% of the loans under moratorium go bad, we have loans of around, bad loans of around 5 lakh crore. And we already have bad loans of around 9 lakh crore. So, if you add 9 lakh plus 5 lakh, you have 14 lakh crore. So, net-net, the RBI projections of a a very severe stress scenario are likely to be true. Chances are it may be even more than that.
Yeah. So if your projections, if the higher band of your projections come true, then we are looking at what, 20 lakh crores?
Which is true. I mean, so basically, if you this is something that Arvind Subramaniam also wrote in his book Off Counsel, where he says that the RBI estimate is usually 20 to 25% lower than the real number. So you can do the math, and it will come. I mean, see, it can be 20 lakh crore, it can be 18 lakh crore. I mean, that we can, there's no point in arguing on that. But the thing is, it will be a very big number, and it is more likely to be bigger than what the RBI is estimating, because the RBI always underestimates, and there is a reason for it. The reason is the RBI is a banking regulator, and if it sort of gives out a very, very honest number, I mean, that's likely to destabilize the banking system, which the RBI obviously doesn't want to do. So what they essentially do is they keep gradually raising the number until the forecast and the actual number end up meeting.
So, depending on which scenario plays out, whether slight stress, moderate stress, severe stress, the banks are going to require capital infusion. They're going to be able to raise capital. And Fitch Ratings have said that Indian banks are likely to require at least $15 billion in fresh capital under a moderate stress and $58 billion in a high stress situation where the domestic economy fails to recover from the coronavirus pandemic related disruption anytime soon. So where are the banks going to raise this capital from?
Good question. I wish I had a straightforward answer. Now see, the problem, what is happening is, if you follow the business press, I think some of the private sector banks, some of the well-run private sector banks have already initiated the process of raising money. But these are not the banks which will eventually end up needing the capital. The capital will be, I mean, these banks will also need capital, but not as much as the capital that will be needed by our public sector banks. Now, the only way public sector banks, one way the public sector banks can raise money is if the government puts fresh money into these banks, which is highly unlikely given the fact that the government doesn't have that kind of money. The other option is to do what the government has been doing over the last few years. What it does is it issues recapitalization bonds. Now, these bonds are then, so let's say a bank requires a capital infusion of 10,000 crore. So what the government does is it issues recapitalization bonds of 10,000 crore, worth 10,000 crore. The bank that requires recapitalization uses the deposits it has to buy these bonds, and then the government takes that money and infuses it into the capital of the bank. Now, so what is essentially being done here is that, it's essentially a smart accounting trick where the deposits of the bank are being turned into capital. The problem with doing this is that, the advantage for the government when it does this is that it doesn't have to put any money that it earns from taxes into these banks. So to that extent, the fiscal deficit, its expenditure doesn't go up, and to that extent, the fiscal deficit doesn't go up. The problem is that these bonds will mature at some point of time, and then they will have to be repaid. So essentially, when the government issues recapitalization bonds, it is basically kicking the can down the road again. The third option is to sort of let these banks raise money directly from the financial markets. But that what that will do is that the government holding in these banks will go below 50%. And for that, I think changes will be required in the Bank Nationalization Act. And so these are the options that are available, and I think it will be very difficult for the government to recapitalize so many banks. I mean, it's going to need a huge amount of money.
So isn't there a fourth option as well, to reduce the number of public sector banks?
No, which is true. So I mean, I guess
four or whatever.
Which is true. I mean, so this is something I've sort of written and extensively over the years that, you don't require, like some of the smaller banks like the Indian Overseas Bank or the United Commercial Bank, UCO Bank, I don't know whether it's United Commercial or Union Commercial. So UCO Bank, I mean, you don't require these banks. I mean, they barely lend any money as a proportion of the overall banking scene in the country, and the amount of capital they suck up and the losses they make are huge. Or something like a Dena Bank, which was merged into the Bank of Baroda. So, some of these banks can just gradually be unwound over a period of time so that they stop sucking the kind of money that the government has to keep investing in them to keep them going.
So, let's come to the economy side of things. So now, the CEC has actually, not just him, others have also blamed the banking sector for holding back India's growth. And he has said that a big reason for the current slowdown is because of problems in the banking sector, such as sold loans and risk aversion and so on. So, do you agree with this assessment?
I think I think it's rubbish of the highest kind. Primarily because, ultimately who owns a bulk of the banks which are in trouble? The government, right? So, if the owner doesn't go about cleaning up what it owns, you cannot blame the, you know, the banks for it. So one is that, you know, we really did not take the banking problem seriously up until 2015. Between 2015 and 2018, the RBI did a good job of trying to clean up the system. 2018, the Ministry of Finance again sort of took over. And since then, you know, all the, you know, banking reform has taken a back seat. So unless you sort of clean up the bad loans and recapitalize these banks over a period of time, also encourage them to sort of recover loans. And I mean, you keep diluting the insolvency and bankruptcy code, how is that going to happen? Or you keep restructuring, you know, all the loans. So, like, you know, one of the points that Urjit Patel makes in his book is how, you know, he keeps talking about zombie loans. And he says that one third of loans given to the real estate sector, where the loans have been restructured over and over again, are zombie loans. So unless you let the, you know, see, it's like this, you know, if there is a wound in the human body, it won't function well. I mean, you have to let the wound heal. You know, you have to do everything. You have to, you know, take medicines which are required. So, I mean, along similar lines, any system which has problems with it, I mean, those problems have to be solved. And unless the government, as the owner of these banks, and, you know, public sector banks in India, I mean, their proportion of in the banking system in India has come down over the years, but they still give out around 60% of the loans and have around 60% of the deposits. So unless these banks are cleaned up, you cannot really blame the banking system for it. I mean, the problem lies with the Department of Financial Services.
So if we are going to be considering the fact that there is a deeply systemic issue that is brewing over a period of time, are there any precautionary steps that the average depositor should be taking to protect her interests?
Yes, I mean, there are things that the depositor needs to do in order to sort of protect her interests. And I think I'll try reading out something that Urjit Patel writes in the conclusion to his new book, Overdraft. And I think this is the only time he mentions the word saver in the entire book. So he says, direct stakeholders, in particular savers, have to be vigilant against risks emanating from potential creeping regulatory and policy complacency. Now, obviously, you know, Mr. Patel doesn't write in a language that all of us can understand. So what he's essentially saying here is, you know, I don't know if you've ever taken a state transport bus in North India. And I mean, I don't know if that's still the case, but you know, there used to be this line sort of printed there, which used to say that sawari apne saman ke khud zimmedar hai. You know, that the yeah, you yeah. Remember that. So this is something like that. What Patel is essentially saying is that the depositors, you know, need to be careful about where they are depositing their money. So you have to be very, very careful about which bank you are banking with. Now, this is not to say that, you know, there will be bank runs and you know, the money will be defaulted on or stuff like that. But, you know, even if a bank is put under a moratorium, as Yes Bank recently was, you will not have access to your money for a given period of time. And money, you know, if you don't have access to your money when you need it, I mean, it's as good as being useless. So one is, you have to be very careful with which bank you bank with. Two, you have to ensure that all your money is not in one bank. You know, you have to spread it around 3 to 4 banks, so that even if there is trouble at one bank, you have access to money in other banks. I mean, beyond this, I don't think there's anything much. I mean, the third option is to keep your money under the mattress. So. Which is not something I would recommend. So,
right. So yeah. So basically, I think the takeaways would be like one could say there are three basic things for the aam aadmi. One is, of course, to beware of the, as you said, potential creeping regulatory complacency with the banking sector. Secondly, to be careful which bank one banks with, and thirdly, to spread the money around across different banks. Vivek, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
Thanks.
And we look forward to doing this again. Yeah.